This is On Becoming, and I'm Dr. Bruce Hollis Benson. We're back with the second half to that episode titled The Future of American Religion. If you heard the first part, which I would suggest is the best way to listen to the two episodes, you'll know that I've been responding to an article titled It's Easter 2050, Here's What American Religion Looks Like. Toward the end of the last episode, we transitioned to the discussion on the podcast On Point, which considers what American Christians believe. That episode is titled, What Do American Christians Believe About Their Religion? In the first episode, we spoke of Lifeway Christian Resources, which is the publishing division of the Southern Baptist Convention. Lifeway has been conducting a survey concerning Christian beliefs in the U.S. since 2014. In their 2022 survey, they found that two-thirds, 66% of people in the U.S. agreed with the following statement. Worshipping alone or with one's family is a valid replacement for regularly attending church. Now, interestingly enough, only 2 years earlier, that number had been 58%. I suspect that the pandemic, a time when many people were unable to attend church or simply decided that it wasn't safe enough to do so, has a lot to do with that number. In fact, I suspect that many people who couldn't or wouldn't attend church during the pandemic found something a little surprising, namely, they were missing church every Sunday, and they didn't really miss it all that much at all. But of course, this point fits well with the overall decline of attendance in church services. Indeed, one of the voices in the episode says the following. Like most of our Christian friends, we stopped attending church around 2018. It just became too political. I'm not surprised there's been a huge drop in church attendance in those who belong to a denomination. What sane Christian wants to be lumped in with the non-stop, mean-spirited Christianity that has been in the news the last 4 years? What's interesting about this point is that it fits rather neatly with the other one, the idea that attending church is not absolutely necessary. In this case, though, it's not so much that the Christian friends just didn't want to worship God anymore. It's that they couldn't deal with their church service being politicized. To be honest, I think that church is becoming too politicized would be a very good reason to stop attending or else to find another church. However, depending on where you live, finding a church that doesn't get political might be difficult. Another finding of the 2022 survey was that 40% of evangelicals do not believe that Jesus is necessarily divine. Among Christians in general, the number is 50%. Yes, exactly half of Christians in the U.S., at least according to this poll, do not believe that Jesus is divine. To be honest, when I first discovered this, I was a little surprised. But then I realized that the problem of our age is that while many of us find the teachings of Jesus to be an excellent paradigm for living, the metaphysics of Christianity grow increasingly difficult to believe. In the On Point episode, they cite some views in a montage. One person says, whether or not in fact he is divine and the Son of God is actually a little irrelevant to me personally, because his example of what we should all be aspiring to be is a miracle in itself. I'm sure Doubt That would not be happy with this little bit of heresy. But it's important to see that the person is more concerned with living out Jesus' teachings in a practical sense. As the person who is identified as Jennifer Hudson says, Jesus' divinity is a little irrelevant to me practically. In other words, her point is that one doesn't have to believe that Jesus is divine in order to follow his teachings. As she goes on to say, her concern isn't with abstract theoretical beliefs, but how to live. From Doubt That's perspective, those who are moving away from such a belief are moving away from Christian orthodoxy. But one could just as easily say that the insistence on Jesus being divine is no longer important to many people. And indeed, if 50% of Christians do not believe that he's divine, I think that kind of answers that question. In the previous episode, I pointed out that large swaths of Christians at various times in various locales have believed very different things regarding who Jesus is. The idea that Jesus is divine is one of the more obvious aspects of Christianity, Though it's interesting that the first three Gospels don't actually identify Jesus as divine. Mark is the earliest Gospel and it presents Jesus and his disciples with a lot of uncertainty. There's no question in Mark that Jesus is somehow special, but his exact status is left pretty vague. In the book, the disciples keep asking, in effect, who is this guy that heals people and says these remarkable things? It's only in the Gospel of John that there is a reasonably clear statement about Jesus' divinity. But John is the last of the Gospels, and he presents us with a much more sophisticated idea of Jesus, someone who is divine and also self-aware. The Jesus in Mark isn't anything like this. One of the difficulties, of course, is that these texts are not designed to be historical texts in the usual sense of someone writing history that is attempting to be scholarly and unbiased. The gospel writers are completely and utterly biased in favor of Jesus. There isn't anything wrong with that, but it does mean that they're not trying to write history in a kind of dispassionate manner. So we can't think of those texts as that kind of text. There's a further point that if we consider what various authors write, we can see a progression over time. Over time, Jesus becomes divine. As I mentioned before, none of the three synoptic gospels make any claim like that. It's only John's version of Jesus that gets this treatment. One of the difficulties is figuring out what Christianity is supposed to be about. Is it about having a theologically sound understanding of Christian doctrine? Well, that's one possibility. However, such a concern doesn't seem all that central to Jesus' teachings. But here we come to a problem of making sense of Paul in relation to the Gospels, particularly the Gospel of Matthew. I'm assuming that the very smart and informed listeners of this podcast already know the standard line that, well, at least since Luther, that we're saved by grace alone. In saying that, Luther saw himself as going back to the Bible and giving a fresh look. Paul talks of how believers are justified by faith. This is in the book of Romans. He expressly says that the law no longer has any force since Jesus' death has made the law necessary. As I've mentioned before, when Christian nationalists start talking about returning to Old Testament law, they're talking about something that goes directly against everything that Paul says. Christian nationalism and Paul, just they do not go well together at all. The whole point of Jesus' death is to get rid of the law, at least according to Paul. On such a reading, the idea that one would go back to the law is in effect negating the very effect of Jesus' death. Paul is adamant that only faith is what saves. As we've discussed, the word translated as faith in the New Testament is always about having faith in Jesus as a person or leader, not about having faith in a body of theological beliefs. However, the Jesus presented in Matthew is all about the law. Jesus says, this is in Matthew 5:1, I have not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. In effect, Jesus is giving an even stricter version of the law. Even the thought of adultery, says Jesus, already counts as adultery. But the most important aspect here is what Jesus says in Matthew 25, the Great Judgment chapter. Even though Jesus increases the expectations for following the law, his formula for salvation turns out to be remarkably simple. Did you ever help feed a hungry person, or visit someone in prison, or simply give someone a glass of water? Well, then you're in. You get to enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so here's the problem. Paul presents a view that requires faith in Jesus, a very specific faith in a very specific person. But the Jesus presented by Matthew doesn't have any requirement like that at all. Indeed, if what Jesus says in Matthew is correct, you wouldn't need to have heard about Jesus or the story of salvation or anything else to be included. The difficulty here, and I'm afraid that I'm not able to fix this, is that Jesus gives us one idea of what one needs to be saved. You do a concrete action that doesn't involve any further belief, and you're good to go. In another passage in Matthew, Jesus says to the rich young ruler that he needs to sell his possessions, and then he's good to go. Paul, on the other hand, thinks you need to have faith in Jesus in order to be saved. Now, If we go with Paul's version of salvation, missionary efforts are utterly necessary. Those who die without a knowledge of Jesus, they're utterly lost. But what Jesus presents in Matthew 25 is the simple idea that being part of the kingdom is simply treating other people with respect. Jesus calls himself the Son of God, but I suspect that his followers weren't quite sure what to make of that claim. If you think about it, it's a very nebulous claim. When such terminology is used, it usually indicates a special relationship to God, like that of a prophet, for instance. It's common in Christianity to say that we are all children of God. So how exactly does that differ from being a son of God? Of course, the answer to that question, what it means to be a son of God, eventually gets worked out in the Nicene Creed and then in further creeds. But Jesus' disciples wouldn't have had access to that information, since it was literally 3 years later that such a formulation was available. Further, the very fact that there were these continuing councils and creeds lets us know that there were considerable controversies, and they didn't just go away. It's instructive to read about the disagreement between Peter and Paul that's found in the Bible itself. Whereas Peter and others in Jerusalem insisted the new converts follow the Hebrew law, Paul interpreted Jesus' death and resurrection as the end of the Mosaic law. That disagreement between them never appears to have been worked out. Put another way, Jesus, Peter, and Paul aren't all saying the same thing. They are saying different things. If all you need to do is to be kind to others, then following the law isn't the ultimate test. Or perhaps we could put it this way. Jesus sums up the law as love God and love your neighbor as yourself. With that in mind, the things Jesus mentioned in Matthew 25, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, etc., are all that really matter. Eventually, however, Paul's view wins out. Not too surprising, since he wrote a number of letters that worked themselves in the New Testament, and of course his letters came out before the Gospels did. But think of the contrast between these two positions. Peter insisted that new converts be circumcised and follow the entire Mosaic law. If Christians had followed that course, Christianity would likely have been merely a small sect that would have died out. But Paul's vision of Christianity won, which meant that converts did not have to worry about mixing different types of cloth or eating shellfish. From all the information available to us, it would appear that the differences between Peter and Paul were never worked out. In other words, there is no text or account that says, oh yeah, see, they met up and everything got, great. In effect, they had two really different ideas. And in effect, Paul won, because the growth of what was to become Christianity took off among Gentiles. But when I ask what Christianity is about, I'm asking what Jesus thought he was doing. I really doubt that he saw himself as starting a new religion. I'm even less convinced that he saw himself as coming to the world in order to die and thus take away the sins of the world. That is the view presented in Mark. But interestingly enough, Luke sees Jesus' death as an event that would cause us to repent and ask for forgiveness. In other words, they give two really different explanations for Jesus' death. Another way of getting at this point is this. What was the focus of Jesus' teaching? Was it to provide a way of living or a way of escaping from life? I realize that some listeners might want to say, well, can't it just be both? But I think you do need to choose at least a little bit. I read Jesus as talking about a way of living that he spoke about using the notion of the kingdom of heaven. As I've mentioned before, the dispensationalist world in which I grew up involved the belief that the Sermon on the Mount was not a message for this world. Rather, it was a vision of what heaven would be like. But Jesus doesn't present it as something to come, something we'd have to wait for in another age. Instead, he makes it clear that such a life is possible here and now. Whether it's also available in the life to come is a further belief. But again, we're back to the problem of metaphysics. The term metaphysics literally means beyond physics, beyond the world of the senses. Metaphysics is all about what stands behind the world that we can see and hear and taste and touch. Well, I don't think that there's a natural rift between science and religion, It is the case that what we know about the world today is, well, a whole lot more than we did before. When the Bible was written, people didn't understand nearly as much about the world as we do. Just to be clear, we know much more of the technical stuff about how the body works, though we may also lack insights that previous eras achieved. Further, make no mistake, I don't think that science simply invalidates the Bible. But to be sure, it makes things more complicated. For instance, Jesus is said to have been born of a virgin. Back when that idea was being formulated and those words were written, people didn't understand all that much about sex. I still think we don't understand all that much about sex, but we at least know how eggs get fertilized. We also know that the term used in Isaiah 7:14, Alma, is much more likely to mean young woman than virgin. And Matthew uses a term in Greek, parthenos, that could mean either two. But really, what exactly of the Christian narrative is lost by translating Alma as young woman rather than virgin? As far as I can tell, the main point of Jesus being born of a virgin is that he isn't affected by sin. Protestants insist on the virgin birth of Jesus, whereas Roman Catholics insist that Mary remained a virgin and that her mother Anne conceived and bore Mary in the Immaculate Conception. But now we've descended into a very difficult realm. What does all of this mean? And what exactly is the evidence for such a belief? Since I really can't speak for Catholics, let me say a word about the Protestant evangelicals. As far as I can tell, the most important aspect about the virginity of Mary for evangelicals is simply that this is what the Bible says, and since it's inerrant, it must be true. They will also argue that Jesus is born free from sin, but I think defending the veracity of the Bible is actually the more important aspect of the two for evangelicals. My main problem with such a view is this. What does it mean? Unless I've just misread something, the plain view of Scripture is that sin is a thing and it comes with a nature, the sin nature. I don't have any problem with the simple idea of sin. Clearly, we all do things that are wrong or sinful. The problem I have is the idea that there's something like a sin nature. It means that we human beings aren't just somehow inherently caught in a web of sin that we can't escape from. Well, that's unless you're a free Methodist. They believe that sinless perfection can be yours in this life, not merely in the life to come. Years ago, I was playing the piano at a Skid Row mission. In order to get a meal and sleep for the night, everyone was required to attend the service. One day, someone got up from the audience and thanked God that he hadn't sinned for 14 years. I can tell you the first thing that went through my mind. Actually, you can probably guess. You just sinned. You've claimed that you've been sinless for 14 years. And that is almost certainly false. I didn't then, and I don't now, believe such a claim. But I don't know what to make of such an idea. If sin comes down to something like selfishness, then the problem seems reasonably clear. We can all become too concerned about our own lives, though the idea of selfishness implies an inordinate preoccupation with self. Keep in mind that the golden rule, do unto others what you'd have them do unto you, presupposes a correct sense of self. Or to make the point in a different way, love your neighbor as yourself only works if we have a proper understanding how we are to love ourselves. It assumes that we do love ourselves, and obviously it assumes that loving ourselves is a good thing. But what I don't get is how this tendency towards sin can be reified into a thing and then called a sin nature. It's one thing to say that people sometimes do bad things. It's a really different thing to say that people are somehow simply ensnared in sin. While the latter might be true, I don't know what would count as evidence that human beings have a sin nature. Unfortunately, this is the kind of claim that one can make, but there's no evidence either way. I have no evidence whatsoever to argue that the idea of human beings being sinful is false. Perhaps there is evidence to make such a case, but I don't know of any. By the way, this kind of claim is similar to many others. For instance, let's just take a belief like this. You believe that everything happens for a reason. Many people believe that. You're welcome to such a belief, though it should be clear that there's no hard evidence that could be adduced for such a claim. Note that the problem here is the following. While one might think that certain things have happened for a reason, the claim everything happens for a reason, is utterly universal. Put a different way, if one wants to make such a claim, then one has to provide at least some kind of defense for the kinds of things that would seem to put such a theory in question. What does one make of, say, a tragic fire in which children die? What was the reason for their suffering and their deaths? I hope you can see that arguing that somehow they had to die seems problematic, because there's no solid evidence for such a claim. When one turns to events like genocide, it becomes incredibly difficult to explain it away as somehow necessary or even happening for a reason. Was the Holocaust God's plan? That seems like a difficult thing to claim, especially since no one would seem to have access to God's mind. The same kind of problem exists for the entire debate regarding free will versus determinism. There is no way that one can prove that either of these is true, though one can provide evidence one way or the other. Similarly, the debate concerning altruism has the same problem. Those who argue, like Nietzsche, for instance, that we're always utterly selfish and never do anything out of altruism, which I'll define here as simply the doing of a good deed without the desire for repayment or reward, have no real support for such a claim. Nietzsche is clearly responding to the Christian affirmation of altruism as being possible and desirable. He wants nothing to do with such a view. But trying to show that Nietzsche is simply wrong is ultimately impossible, since we don't have anything like clear and indisputable evidence that shows that altruistic behavior does indeed exist. My own way of dealing with this last problem is that I believe that human action always is mixed. All of our action has mixed motives. Don't hear that as necessarily bad. I think it's just part of being human. In other words, I think we can be genuinely concerned for other people while still being concerned for ourselves. I don't think it's one or the other. In other words, there's probably nothing like pure altruism or pure selfishness. We can be less selfish and thus more concerned about other people, but we can also be primarily concerned about ourselves. One of the true conceptions with this entire debate is that it's often conducted as if I or other people are completely independent of others, in the sense that I can simply decide to be concerned for others or not. The reality is that unless you're a sociopath, you need other people. Being concerned about their welfare could be seen as simply selfish. However, the moment you actually become concerned about the welfare of other people, that's the moment that altruism enters the scene. Even if you're only somewhat concerned about the welfare of someone else, your concern reaches the place of actual altruism. Now, I want to go back to the survey done by Lifeway. And something that Lifeway found that's a little bit more troubling is that 45% of respondents said that, and now I'm quoting, "religious belief is a matter of personal opinion rather than objective facts." Oh, let me make it clear that my questions regarding the nature of God, the nature of human beings, the reality of sin, etc., 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 are questions that I view as very much matters of fact. Either God exists or God does not exist. It's not just a matter of personal opinion. Which is to say, you may decide that God does not exist. That has absolutely nothing to do with whether God does exist or not. To be sure, any given person is going to have to make a choice regarding God's existence or non-existence, but I don't see how that option is somehow disconnected from the wider question of how the world works. Now, it's also interesting that the survey revealed that 2/3 of those who attend church regularly believe that God, I'm quoting now, accepts the worship of all religions. That point is encouraging, for it means that many people are willing to accept diverse religious beliefs as valid in some way. But again, whereas Delphat writes as if the divinity of Jesus has been a settled thing for ages, we've seen that it is a view that has been problematic ever since Jesus walked on the earth. We talked about asking what Jesus was all about, in the sense of, what is he trying to teach? The divinity of Jesus is absolutely important if you think that Jesus' main purpose was to die for our sins. Again, the whole argument about atonement theory is dense and kind of weird, and probably a subject for another episode. It's also important if you think that Christianity is mainly about the life to come, because then Jesus' death can be thought of as the thing that makes going to heaven possible. But let's finish up this episode by considering a few more things that Douthat says. He writes, "Clearly, the old order of Protestant denominationalism, Methodists and Presbyterians and Episcopalians clustering around the city green, no longer defines our religious life." I think this statement is just simply wrong. The mainline denominations are not as vibrant as they once were, but they still exist and exert influence. I'm sure Douthat would be happy that Episcopalians have played an enormously important role in extending recognition to the LGBTQ+ community. It's also important to realize that some of those who have left evangelicalism, remember there's been an excess of about 20% between 2016 and 2020, have found places in the mainline denominations. It's at this point that Douthat starts talking about neo-traditionalists, which he describes as liturgical and doctrinally conservative Christians, with a Roman Catholic core orbited by some Reformation factions, Calvinists especially, as well as some Eastern Orthodox churches small but flush with converts. In effect, Douthat completely writes off the mainline denominations and then celebrates his own Catholicism as somehow hovering above the fray. But then it just gets bizarre. He writes that the neo-traditionalists have created rather than inherited their conservative culture. I'm really not sure what that's supposed to mean. If you're Roman Catholic, you may choose not to believe everything in the Catechism. I suspect that most Catholics don't believe all of those things, though I haven't done a survey, so I can't provide any results. Then Douthat moves on to those he terms mere Christians. I suspect that's some kind of vague reference to C.S. Lewis, who wrote a book titled Mere Christianity. But what Douthat says is that these folks are, and now I'm quoting, Americans we would call ex-evangelical or non-denominational Protestant today, but terms like denomination and Protestant seem quaint in our imagined 2050, and even evangelical is falling into abeyance. He then goes on to describe these folks as people who just identify as Christians, with names like Elevate and Rise and Resurrection, institutions that are theologically conservative, but not doctrinally intense, and not liturgical at all. Well, I've tried to make it clear that even churches with names like Rise have liturgies. They're very different liturgies than ones associated with, say, Episcopalians and Catholics. I don't think that makes them any less liturgical, though. Indeed, I suspect that if liturgy is a way of organizing a service, then the megachurches have probably put more thought into their current liturgy than most churches that are merely following worship patterns laid down long ago, since they exist primarily to reach those who are unchurched, and their target demographic makes their planning more precise. I'm talking about the megachurches. Personally, I just don't connect to the liturgy that characterizes seeker-sensitive churches. But it would be a mistake to simply write these people off. Further, while seeker-sensitive churches tend not to advertise all of their beliefs in advance, leading some to complain of bait and switch, it's far too broad a generalization to say that they are not doctrinally intense. Such a comment can only come from a place of ignorance. I'm sorry, I think that's the only place it can come from. That ignorance is even more glaring when Douthat suggests that the kinds of people who attend such churches are ex-evangelical. The vast majority of such churches would qualify as evangelical, though it's probably the case that there must be some, as in at least a few of these churches, that see themselves as having gone beyond evangelicalism. Then Douthat goes on to say something that seems even more strange. He writes that the mere Christians have fewer advanced degrees than the neo-traditionalists. I'm sorry. While Douthat wants to elevate his tradition over that of mere Christians, there just really isn't much truth to this claim. True, the Catholic tradition has a far, far richer intellectual tradition than do evangelicals. There's no comparison between the two. But I think that if you were to take a Roman Catholic church and then compare it to a mere Christian church, say, in the same town, you'd find that the mere Christian church likely has just as many advanced degrees among its members, and perhaps even more. Then Douthat writes, at one edge, the mere Christian category blurs into Pentecostalism. No, actually, the Pentecostal churches make it pretty clear that they're Pentecostal. I don't think there's any blurring. Speaking in tongues is simply not a part of evangelical worship. It's not part of Episcopalian worship. It's not part of Roman Catholic worship. It's not, you know, you can see where this is going. While evangelicals or other Protestants may decide to attend such a church, I don't think that constitutes blurring. What I hope I've made clear is that what Christians believe has always been changing. Indeed, here's a helpful way of thinking about that change. Rather than there being something like an initial established orthodoxy that gets questioned, it's so much better to think of orthodoxy and heterodoxy existing in tandem from the beginning. Many views that were once considered orthodox have now been labeled heterodox. And it's gone the other way too. And that leads me to wonder about the future in a way that Douthat seems to miss. In his version of how things will look in 2050, it's kind of a slow, agonizing death of traditional Orthodox religion. But that's such a dismal view. How about this instead? What if evangelicals were to finally recognize that much of what they preach is heretical? What if they were to realize that evangelicals have particularly emphasized the most oppressive texts in the Bible, such as the forgery known as 1 Timothy, in which we read, "Let a woman learn in silence with full submission. I permit no woman to teach or have authority over a man." Douthat talks about the possibility of, and now I'm quoting, a liberal form of non-denominational Christianity built by the errors of disillusioned ex-evangelicals. That would be an interesting development, though I think it's kind of unlikely. But I'm grateful for any evangelicals, former or current, who realize that Jesus' teachings are life-giving. I just wish they'd focus on those teachings. We'll stop there. Thanks for listening to On Becoming. I'm Dr. Bruce L. Spencer.